Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello and welcome to SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Justin Dreher, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. Today we're here to talk about Polselli v. IRS, which was argued before the court on March 29th. And we're joined by Professor David Schizer, who is the Harvey R. Miller Professor of Law and Economics at Columbia Law School. He also served as Dean of the Law School from 2004 to 2014. He started as dean at the age of 35, making him the youngest dean in Columbia's history. He is also one of the nation's leading tax scholars, and his research also focuses on nonprofits, energy law, and corporate governance. And we're very happy to have him on SCOTUScast today. So, Professor Schizer, thank you for joining us.
Justin, it is such a treat to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right. So I think to start us off, why don't we talk about the background of the case, the facts, and how it kind of got here to the Supreme Court.
So this is a pretty colorful case, and you might not think it when what you hear is that it's about interpreting an obscure provision of tax procedure, but it really isn't that at all. There is a tax gap in the U.S., real challenges in collecting taxes, something the government emphasized. At the same time, the IRS has pretty immense power, and the question here is how much power did Congress mean to give the IRS? And so we have a really important issue being hashed out. And the argument also shows different approaches to statutory interpretation. So let's get to the specifics. And here's the question. If the IRS decides that you haven't paid all of your taxes and they want to collect back taxes from you, how broad is their power to get records, not just from you, but from third parties, from your spouse, from your lawyers, from your friends? So a taxpayer named Remo Polselli was assessed $2 million in back taxes. And the government suspected that he was concealing assets, possibly with his wife, Hannah, and possibly through his law firm, Abraham and Rose. So the IRS wanted this information about Hannah and about the law firm, and they issued a summons to Hannah's bank and to the law firm's bank asking for their bank records. The government did not give either Hannah or the law firm notice. The bank told them. So Hannah and the law firm brought an action trying to quash the summons. The government said, you can't do that. We don't have to give the wife or the law firm notice, and they don't have standing to bring a motion to quash. And that's what the case is about. Is that true? Do government issues a summons to third parties, like the taxpayer's wife and lawyer? Do they have to give third parties notice? And can the third parties bring a motion to quash? Now, when the IRS issues summons to third parties, they do have to give this, and the third party can bring a motion to quash saying, hey, the summons is too broad and you're asking for things that have nothing to do with the taxpayer and all that. Exception in 7609C2D, which basically talks about a summons issued, quote, in aid of the collection of an assessment made or a judgment rendered against the person with respect to whose liability the summons is issued. In other words, when you're at the collection phase, the government is saying, we have really broad power. We can go after third parties. They don't have the ability to get judicial review to ask us to stop. And so the question is that right? And so the taxpayer, of course, was saying, no, the exception applies. The government said, no, we can do this. And so basically the case comes up through the Sixth Circuit and the government won there. But there was a dissent by Raymond Ketledge, George W. Bush appointee. And it turns out there's a circuit split on this very issue. There's a circuit split on whether there is a notice requirement and whether there is an ability to challenge when the government sends a summons to a third party. And so the Sixth Circuit said, nope. Government can do it. Judge Ketledge said, oh, they can't do it. There is an exception. Basically, you have to, the government avoids the notice requirement only when they're asking for things that are closely enough connected to the taxpayer. The taxpayer has to have some kind of a legal interest in the third party's records. And if the taxpayer has a legal interest, then yeah, the government can get those records and there's no notice requirement, no ability to file a motion to stop it. But otherwise, third parties need to get notice and they need to have the ability to contest. Judge Kethledge was echoing something the Ninth Circuit had said. That's the pro-taxpayer rule and it stands on its own. But meanwhile, the Sixth Circuit, in finding for the government here, was going along with both the Seventh Circuit and the Tenth Circuit that had come before. So you have the Sixth, Seventh, and Tenth Circuits on one side, pro-government, and the taxpayers got the Ninth Circuit on their side.
All right. So thank you for taking us up to the Supreme Court. So I guess shifting to oral argument now, were there any humorous moments in there or anything worth noting?
There were actually some unusually entertaining moments in this argument. One of my favorites is when Justice Gorsuch is purporting to paraphrase something Justice Kagan said. Sort of, here's the argument, but I'd like to press further. And she interjects and says, I think it was a bit more than that. So everyone laughed. And also earlier in the argument, there was a really interesting colloquy about how close a connection there needs to be between the third party records on one hand and the taxpayers and the taxpayer on the other. And so Justice Thomas is pushing back. This is the taxpayer's argument. There has to be a close connection. And Justice Thomas is saying, where does it say that in the statute? So the taxpayer's lawyer, Shay Dvoretsky, former Scalia clerk, knows how to make a textualist argument. And he says, well, it's all in that phrase, in the aid of collection. And then he starts interpreting the words in aid of. He says, and he makes this point in what I thought was a very entertaining way. He says, okay, think about this argument today. When I wrote my notes for what I was going to say to you, Justice Thomas, those notes were in the aid of winning this argument. That's the kind of close connection that I'm looking about, that I'm looking at. But what about when I went to law school years ago? Maybe the attenuated connection between my legal education and what I'm saying here. But law school wasn't in the aid of this argument. And I wouldn't say that it was, Justice Thomas, not only because I went to Yale Law School. And then he paused and Justice Thomas roared laughter and everybody laughed. In fact, Justice Thomas kept laughing for a little while. And then Shay finished his point and said, but also, of course, because there isn't a close enough connection. But my alma mater, Yale Law School, featured prominently in this argument as well.
I'm still waiting for my my alma mater of Georgetown. I haven't gone to law school, but my undergrad alma mater to make more appearances. We need to step up our game. So, in terms of the substantive takeaways of oral argument or surprises, were there any I guess good points made in service of either side? And I guess kind of bouncing off that question, do you have any sense of where this decision will fall based on how the argument went or your views of it?
Mm-hmm. So look, there's a way in which if you see a circuit split with three circuits on one side and the Ninth Circuit on the other, at least in the old days when I was a law clerk, the betting would be against the Ninth Circuit. And I would say that it's interesting. This is an old split. The Ninth Circuit is a 2000 opinion. The other circuits were 98 and 99. It was just the Sixth Circuit that weighed in now, which I guess prompted the Supreme Court to take the case. But I have to say, appearances can be deceiving when you focus on the arguments here and when you listen to what the justices were saying. This was a pretty interesting debate. And I would say it was mostly a debate about different approaches to textualism. But there was also real focus on both the language and on canons of construction and disagreements about how to interpret them. But there were also glimmers of a different perspective, more of a sort of a policy critique coming from Justices Sotomayor and Justice Jackson. Their questions really expressed some concern about overreach on the part of the government. But let's start with the language, because that's where the argument began, and obviously that is what the court is going to focus on. It does come down to this question, in aid of collection. The taxpayer, as I said, is arguing that this in aid of collection exception is really limited yes, the government doesn't have to get notice and there's no opportunity to object when it's an aid of collection, but that means something narrow. It means that the records have to be something where the taxpayer has a legal interest. So Justice Thomas said, wait, you know, where does it say that? And there were vigorous debates about that. And then I'd say another argument that featured really prominently is the surplusage canon, because one of the things I haven't mentioned yet is that in addition to that language about an aid of collection, there's another provision that says you also, the government also doesn't need to give notice and people can't complain if they're going after the records of other third parties, a fiduciary or a transferee. If the taxpayer paid someone money or someone who's a fiduciary for the taxpayer, you can get that and they can't object. Government can just do that without any process. And so the taxpayer's argument is, well, wait a minute, the way the government is reading the statute, if they can just do it as soon as they assess taxes, then they could have done it also with transferees and fiduciaries. And the second clause, it's meaningless. They've said it already in the first clause, if you read it the way the government reads it, which is why you can't read it the way the government reads it. The first clause has to just focus on records where the taxpayer has an interest, so that the second clause can matter, because that's where you're looking at a transferee or a fiduciary. So then you had a bit of a spirited debate about that. Justice Kagan weighed in to say, no, I don't think that that's right. Basically, Congress was reiterating a point, but they were making a separate point too. She's saying, when the government tries to collect taxes, there are really two sources. One source is the taxpayer, the second source is the people who've gotten money from the taxpayer. And so they were basically having, they included two different government has power in going after either type, the government also added a second point. Hey, that second clause, it's about even before we assess tax. Even before we assess tax, we can use clause two. And clause one is about after we do this assessment, which is the formal step. Justice Sotomayor weighed in and said, no, wait a minute. Don't you have guidance within the IRS that you won't do that? And Ephraim McDowell, representing the government, did concede, yes, no, we have guidance, but it's not the statute. It's just our practice. It's just guidance to agents, but we do have that power. We just don't use it. So what you have is a debate about the language. You have a debate about one canon. Then there's a debate about another canon. Justice Barrett weighed in and she said, well, I see the point about the surplusage canon. That is an important point, but there's another canon that we need to worry about. And that's the waiver of sovereign immunity. And here what the government is doing is determining when it allows itself to be sued as part of the tax collection process. And aren't we supposed to construe waivers of sovereign immunity narrowly? So again, we've got language, we've got a canon, and now we've got another canon. Jay Voretsky weighed in and said, well, no, the waiver here is clear. This is just an exception to the waiver. And so once the waiver is clear, you should read the exceptions narrowly. And on the argument went. But then that sort of evokes a third canon which came up in the debate, and that just has to do with exceptions and the general rule. So the point is, what we've been talking about, what the court was talking about, is an exception. The general rule in this statute is that third parties do get notice, and third parties can contest, and they can say, hey, wait a minute, that's too broad, and that's none of your business, and that has nothing to do with the taxpayer. They do generally have that right, and this is just an exception to that. And so there was a suggestion by some, well, maybe because it's an exception, it's supposed to be narrow. But that became a launching point for a broader critique. And Justice Jackson weighed in and basically said, so under your reading, Mr. McDowell, under your reading, can't the government pretty much do whatever it wants? Can it get pretty much anything? So you say they're trying to go after a law firm. Can they ask for the law firm's bank records and then start looking at the law firm's other clients? And aren't there all kinds of privacy issues? And aren't there all kinds of attorney-client privilege risks there? And what I thought was interesting is that Justice Jackson didn't really connect that question to a particular point in the language. I think she was really just weighing in on the policy, in a sense. And Justice Sotomayor did something similar. I love what she said. She said, there's a whole lot about the IRS collection mechanism that has been criticized and continues to be criticized by the world, including me. And people laughed. And then she said, if you've been audited, you know. And then she said, again, why can the government just approach innocent third parties and say, we want your records, we want all of your records? Doesn't there have to be some reason to think the third parties are in on it? And actually, Justice Thomas weighed in on this as well. He basically said, you say that the trigger here, government, is an assessment. But an assessment just means that you've decided that someone owes tax. And isn't that just a bookkeeping notation? And basically, once you put this in the book, yes, this taxpayer owes tax, you're saying you can go after their lawyer, you can go after the individual lawyers in the firm, you can go after the clients of the firm. Can you really do that? So it was at this point that Justice Gorsuch weighed in, throwing a bit of a lifeline to the government lawyer. And he said, isn't there some limit in the phrase in aid of? You can't just do a random fishing expedition, no shot in the dark. You have to have some reason, but maybe you don't have to go to the point where you have to show that the taxpayer has a legal interest in the documents in the way the taxpayer is suggesting. So Ryan McDowell, obviously a good lawyer, sensed that he was being given a lifeline and he took it, but a bit gingerly, he said, well, there has to be some connection, but not much of a connection, not a close connection. So this is an argument that really exposed a lot of different interesting issues within this case. And you asked how I think it's going to come out. And the answer is, I'm not sure. If I had to guess, I think probably the government is going to win here. And by my count, it seemed like the Chief Justice was very much supportive of their position. I think on balance, Justice Thomas was. Justice Kagan, to me, seemed clearly to be. Justice Gorsuch also. So that gives them 4 votes. It's very possible that Justices Jackson and Sotomayor will come out against in favor of the taxpayer. And that leaves us with Justices Alito and Kavanaugh, and they actually didn't ask any questions. So I'm very interested to see what they do.
So I know we touched on it briefly about privacy concerns and attorney-client privilege implications, but you know, depending on how this case comes out, are there any important implications in how this affects things going forward?
Yeah, look, I mean, no taxpayer will be comfortable with the idea that once the government has decided that they filled out the return the wrong way and there's been an initial process and the government has given you a chance to make your case and said, no, we don't agree with you. And once that happens, they can basically just start issuing summonses to your lawyer and to your spouse and to who knows who else. And those third parties don't have any ability to contest it, which is basically the government's position. Now, the government says, well, but wait a minute. If we ask the bank itself has the right to contest. It's just, you know, not the wife, not the law firm. And one wonders how hard the bank will try. I mean, what's in it for them to say no? I'm not sure. But I do think that the issue in and of itself is interesting. And frankly, to me, what was in ways even more interesting is the light that this argument shed on the court's approach to statutory interpretation in 2023. Because the case on the side of the taxpayer here, it's the IP decision from 2000 in the Ninth Circuit, was just fundamentally different. They did a painstaking analysis of legislative history. They looked at committee reports, they had all kinds of quotes, and they basically said, we find the statutory language a bit unclear, and we look to the legislative history, and when we do that, our judgment is that Congress was really trying to protect privacy here, and this exception was supposed to be narrow, and here's what we think they meant. And it is fair to say that that is not an approach that is as common today. No one cited legislative history today in the argument. Those arguments were simply not made. And I'm reminded of what Justice Kagan said a few years ago, we are all textualists now. And she certainly did sound like one. In the argument today, I would say it looks like they all pretty much are textualists with the possible exceptions of Justices Sotomayor and Jackson, who seemed very focused on policy considerations that were not explicitly within the text.
All right. I think that kind of brings us towards the closing end of the episode. Thank you for unpacking that so well and thoroughly. Are there any kind of closing comments you'd like to leave us with about this case, its implications, oral argument, anything's on the table?
Just that I think you'd enjoy listening to it. If you have the time, it's a really interesting one.
All right, Professor Schiller, thank you for joining us today and unpacking the case here, which is much, I agree, much more interesting than one would think at first blush. So thank you.
Thank you, Justin.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.